Hello there, folks. Greetings and welcome to another episode of the Undercover Bubble Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Moore, and I'd like to thank you very much for joining me once again to take a deep dive into this interesting thing that we call the conservative media bubble. Now, as you're probably aware, it's my job on this podcast to bring you sources of information that you might otherwise not be able to see or hear from that give you sort of a perspective into what the bubble and the GOP and the right in general is doing to try and push their narrative and to further their goal of an authoritarian, anti-democratic state. And so with that in mind, what I wanted to do with this episode is, rather than looking at how the bubble and the right has reacted to something that recently happened, as I did last episode, what I'm going to do today is go through a piece of propaganda that came out actually almost a year ago now, but I think is really important to go through and to break down to sort of see how the right is justifying both their narrative and the way in which they believe things will get fixed. So today I'm going to be talking about Patriot Purge. Now, if you haven't heard of this, it was a quote-unquote documentary that came out, I believe, back in December of last year. And it was the first in-depth piece that came out on Fox Nation, which was the, at the time, brand new streaming service from Fox News for people for whom Fox News just wasn't enough conservative media if they wanted to just ingratiate themselves even further into the bubble because Fox News wasn't enough. You had Fox Nation. And a big part of what made Fox Nation so enticing and so successful, I guess, as opposed to other streaming platforms, was the fact that people like Tucker Carlson were going to start doing their own original content. And I remember when Fox Nation first started out, they were just bombarding Fox News viewers with commercials for this documentary, for Patriot Purge. Basically say, you're going to find out the real truth behind January 6th. Who are the real culprits behind it? Who's trying to cover up what actually happened? What's the real goal here behind what happened on January 6th? The only way you can find out is to watch Patriot Purge when it comes out on Fox Nation exclusively. And as far as I know, it's still exclusively on Fox Nation. But I found a way to watch it. I'm not going to tell you how I found a way to watch it. All I will say is it was not illegal. I did not give any money to Fox Nation. And if you look hard enough, if you really want to watch it, you can find it. So I'll leave it at that and just say that I was able to watch it and I took notes on it and have some conclusions to be drawn from it. So I'm just going to dive right in to Patriot Purge, presented as a Tucker Carlson original on Fox Nation. So the first interesting thing to note about Patriot Purge is that it's not actually just a long one documentary. It's in three parts. But each part is about 20 minutes long. Total length is just over an hour. And I assume that this is to allow the streaming service to run a bunch of MyPillow commercials. But anyway, Patriot Purge starts off with a somber warning. We see slow-mo and stylized footage of January 6th combined with some just generic stock military footage, and a very official-looking guy in a suit and tie looks right in the camera during an interview and says, "The domestic war on terror is here, coming after half the country." Obviously, he's referring to Trump supporters here, and they will make that clear as this documentary goes on. As I said, as he's saying this and other sort of inflammatory things, there's lots of flashy imagery and montages of January 6th violence. This guy calls it War on Terror 2.0. And I think it's kind of ironic that he calls it that because the people who stormed the Capitol were indeed domestic terrorists. They were labeled as such, treated as such, and deserved to be. But this guy doesn't stop there. He immediately compares the holding of January 6th insurrectionists to Guantanamo Bay. And then another guy comes on, and who is clearly even more pissed off than this guy is, and he says in a very gruff voice, "America isn't a place where you hold people in solitary. That's not America. That's a gulag." And he uses this opportunity to say that they are purging the military of any dissenting voice. And they punctuate this with the now infamous quote of George W. Bush justifying his invasion of Iraq, saying, "Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists." Applause. So I assume this is just the intro, sort of giving you a play-by-play of exactly the points that they're going to be going through in this documentary. And that makes sense, because a lot of times you see nowadays on trailers for new movies that are coming out, they sort of show the big hits from the trailer before the actual trailer starts. Then they say, "Trailer starts now." But anyway, they conclude this sort of intro to the documentary by going into an overview of how America used deception to justify the war in Iraq, which is actually true, by the way. So that sort of surprised me. Like, right off the bat, they actually say something that's honest and real and correct. But then Tucker himself comes on, looks directly at the camera, and he says, "The same people who pushed the Iraq WMD lies are now warning of a white terror army." So just right off the bat, we all know that Tucker Carlson is a closet white supremacist, and he loves to sort of subtly and more recently not so subtly push direct white supremacist viewpoints on his show. And so just right off the bat, in literally the first sentence he speaks, he's already pushing white supremacist theories, saying that the government is now warning of a white terror army. And he says it in a way that's definitely facetious and meant to be sort of joking. Like, how could you actually think that there's a white terror army coming? But again, we all know he's a closet white supremacist. So he, in my view, is really sort of just subtly nudging, poking the stick at these white supremacists, saying, "Hey guys, you better pay attention. This is what they think of you now." He goes on to say that January 6th is being used as a pretext to defame Americans and strip them of constitutional rights. He punctuates this by saying that they are tying white nationalist terrorism to Trump voters. The irony here being, of course, is that the Trump voters have already done this themselves. It's pretty clear if you go on any sort of pro-Donald Trump, right-wing, any sort of platform or forum or anything like that, that the people who participate in these discussions where the plot for January 6th originated, they're all pretty much white supremacists. They're all pretty much Christian nationalists. So it's not a stretch to imagine that white supremacist terrorism has direct ties to Trump voters. I'm not saying that all Trump voters are terrorists, of course not. But the ones who have committed these acts overwhelmingly seem to be Trump voters. But what's funny is that Tucker follows this up by saying, "When you shove it in people's throats enough, they come to believe it." And it's kind of funny because, A, this is something that I've always said about politics in general, not just on the right, that if you say something loud enough, strong enough, and often enough, it doesn't matter how crazy it is, people will eventually start to believe it. And Trump himself knows this. He even said as much during one of his speeches not too long ago.
"If you say it enough, they'll start to believe you. It's called disinformation."
And he was trying to use the term ironically to say that the disinformation was against him, but it's pretty clear just from even just the way he says it in that speech, but more importantly, his actions and what he's done since he was out of office, that he really is trying to paint this narrative of the state and the entire Democratic apparatus and half the country is against him personally. And that's what the big lie is really about. It's not so much about voter fraud. It's not so much about Republicans versus Democrats. It's about the entire apparatus of the governmental state is controlled by a shadowy cabal of Democrats that's coming after Trump personally. And it reminds me of a quote from Mein Kampf that I used in one of my earlier Undercover Bubble podcasts. And I'd like to go back to it real quick just because I think it really explains the mindset behind what Trump is doing. So again, this is Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf explaining the importance and the effectiveness. Quote, "In the big lie, there is always a certain form of credibility, because the broad classes of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously, even though the facts which prove this to be so may be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation. End quote. And honestly, I could not think of a better possible explanation of what Trump is doing. He is pushing this big lie specifically because he knows his people will believe it. And as I've explained on this show before, one of the main tenets of the bubble is that you're not supposed to ask questions. You're not supposed to ask for more information. You're just supposed to take what's being fed to you and assume it's gospel. And that just fits right in with the way that Trump is trying to establish his narrative of the deep state and how they're just after me personally. Because if that's the truth, and there's no reason for anyone in the bubble to believe that it's not, that is big. Or as Trump would say, huge. And we can apply this mentality to the bubble in the way that people like Tucker Carlson and networks like Fox News put out their reporting. Because they're already so invested in the big lie, and pushing the big lie has made them so successful, both socially and commercially, that even when there's overwhelming evidence disproving what they're saying, it doesn't matter. Because the big lie is so big that no one thinks that it's a lie anymore. It's too big to be a lie. There's no way he'd lie about something so important, something so game-changing, something so significant as the entire deep state cabal of the Democratic Party going after one man because they're afraid of his power. And this is what makes this mentality so dangerous, is that they cannot be convinced otherwise. No matter what facts you put in front of them, oh, the facts are wrong. And I can tell you, I know plenty of people personally who share this viewpoint, that if I give them facts and say, this is what's actually happening, they'll just say, oh, well, your facts are wrong. You got your facts from CNN or AP or Reuters or one of those quote-unquote news organizations. They don't know what's really going on. And it just perpetuates and perpetuates and perpetuates, and there's no way of getting out of it. And that's what's so sad about this situation, and I'll get into it a little bit more when I'm done talking about Patriot Purge, that the only way these people might snap out of their stupor is something happening that just cannot be ignored or disputed. And I thought that was January 6th. I was hoping it would be. But as Patriot Purge is showing, they are using January 6th as an excuse and an opportunity to push even more of this propaganda to try and write the narrative for themselves. So going back to Patriot Purge, when Tucker is mentioning that they're tying white nationalist terrorism to Trump voters, he then asks the question of, what exactly happened on January 6th? His first interview is with a guy named Darren Beatty. He's the founder of Revolver News, and he calls him one of the few people who actually did real reporting on January 6th. And so, as I am known to do, when I saw Revolver News, I've never heard of these guys, so I looked him up. And just a quick 5-minute search on Google reveals that Revolver News is actually a conservative conspiracy site. No surprise there. The homepage lists stories such as the final solution for the unvaccinated and a surge in pedophilia activity since Joe Biden became president. So yeah, these guys are basically QAnon adherents. Again, no surprise there that Tucker's going to them for confirmation. What's funny is that they claim to be the new Drudge Report right on their website, since it no longer represents America. And by America, of course, they mean conservative America. But what this guy does is immediately starts making a huge deal about the death of Officer Brian Sicknick. He says that every explanation of it, and they go through every single different explanation that popped up in the news after he died, and says that every explanation of it was a lie. Which I wouldn't characterize it as a lie so much as more information was coming out and they kept changing their story. So to be fair, yeah, it does look a little strange when you keep changing your story about what actually happened to him, but that doesn't mean they were lying. And they always retracted their stories and said, "are bad." Which, by the way, is something you never see happen in the bubble. And the reality is, the autopsy, the official autopsy, showed that Sicknick died, quote, of natural causes. This was the actual wording that they used. And apparently what happened was that after the Capitol attack, he had two strokes and he died of those. And the obvious question that begs to be answered there for me is, what caused those strokes? It is certainly not unheard of for strokes to be caused by stress, both mental and physical. And it's known that he was part of the group of officers that basically got assaulted by January 6th rioters. So I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that he died of those strokes from the physical and mental stress caused by the January 6th riot. But of course, Tucker isn't going to use this information because it doesn't fit his narrative. The narrative being that January 6th was a peaceful protest that got out of control, and even that's going to change, as we'll see. And Officer Sicknick just happened to die of natural causes right after the riot happened. So, move along, people. Nothing to see here. And in fact, Tucker does move right along, talking to Ali Alexander, the guy who organized the Stop the Steal rally in the first place. And wearing a very well-fitted business suit on top of a super posh, looks like a hotel in the middle of a city, he says that he believes he's being targeted once again for his race because he's a minority in dissent. He draws comparisons between what he had to deal with as a Muslim post 9/11 and what he has to deal with now as a non-white Trump supporter, as if his race has everything to do with how he's being treated by the media. And this, of course, is absolutely ridiculous. He's not being, quote-unquote, unfairly treated by the media because he's not white. He's being treated the way he is by the media and social media because he organized the rally that ended up being the January 6th insurrection. And I actually find it kind of ironic that he's since fully cooperated with the January 6th committee, although publicly he is still pushing this narrative. And continuing to do so, he laments that he's been kicked off social media for his beliefs and says that out of over 500 rallies, no Stop the Steal rally has ever had violence. So when I heard this stat, I was like, wow, okay, this is the first actual piece of statistical information that they've cited in this documentary. So, of course, I had to check this information for myself. And after not even 2 minutes of Google searching, I found December 12th, 2020, the Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C., that descended into violence in which 4 people were stabbed and 33 were arrested. So right away, we know that this statement is a lie. Not to mention all the violent rhetoric we saw on social media before January 6th, basically saying that we need to take our country back and storm the Capitol and get the firing squad ready. Pence goes first. These are real things that were on, I guess it was Parler at the time, that they were talking about doing on January 6th. And to sort of further this narrative of his that Stop the Steal is a peaceful multi-denominational movement, he mentions the fact that some Bernie voters in 2020, after Joe Biden got the nomination, thought that Bernie's nomination was stolen from him by the Democratic bigwigs, who basically said that Bernie is too extreme of a candidate for us to run in the general election, so we need someone like Joe Biden. And A, it turns out they were right, And B, yeah, there are some legitimate grievances about the way that was done, but I wouldn't call it stolen, because it ultimately came down to people just voted more for Joe Biden than they did for Bernie Sanders. It's not as if the Democrats did anything so crazy as, I don't know, I'm just spitballing here, trying to install fake electors in order to win an election that they actually lost. GOP wouldn't know anything about that, would they? Oh, wait, it's actually turning out now that not only did they know something about that, they actually tried to do it and took efforts to cover it up. But that's a story for another time. For now, we're going to go back to Ali Alexander and him talking about Bernie voters and saying that the fact that some of them thought his nomination was stolen proves to him that Stop the Steal is a bipartisan movement. And with this statement and the way they're characterizing Ali Alexander in this documentary, it really sort of seems to me that they're trying very hard to separate white supremacy from the Stop the Steal rally and January 6th itself. But why is that? Are they trying to defend white supremacy? Again, I don't think they're trying to do this out in the open. I think they know how bad that would be for their reputation and for the network. But Tucker Carlson has been known to push white supremacist viewpoints, and this is no different. So anyway, Ali Alexander then actually admits in this right-wing documentary that he planned the Stop the Steal rally with members of Congress. Obviously, we know now that this happened because of the January 6th committee, but this was back in December of last year when we really didn't know much at all about what actually went down on January 6th and the events leading up to it. So at the time, this would have been a big reveal. And they expand on it. Ali Alexander even plays some excerpts from the call in which he says, yeah, I have a couple of House members on the phone with me here. And he says, in this conversation, there was no talk of insurrection. Maybe not by you, but as we've learned from the January 6th committee since then, there was certainly a lot of talk of it on places like Parler and Gab by the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and people who agreed with them. So after his interview, Tucker then plays a clip from his speech on January 6th saying, Republicans, we are the people you must represent, or we'll replace you with patriots. And that gets a big cheer out of the crowd. And while he's saying this, his voiceover says, it was about standing with the conservative movement, and it unfortunately spiraled out of control. And honestly, I'd say just that replace you with patriots line alone might be enough to be considered incitement, especially if, as he mentions next, there were, quote, maybe 100,000 people there. And of course, there was nothing anywhere near that. It was probably closer to 4,000 or 5,000, maybe 10,000 if you consider the people who didn't storm the Capitol. But with that in mind, Tucker then asked the question, if the Stop the Steal movement didn't conspire to commit violence, then who did? So in other words, Tucker is equating one guy saying he had nothing to do with January 6th, which of course he did, to everyone being involved with January 6th, not conspiring to violence. The whole movement must be innocent, which means none of them are culpable for anything that happened. This, of course, is an anecdotal fallacy, because this one guy says he wasn't involved. No one was. And again, he plays this audio behind clips of the militarization of the Capitol that happened after January 6th. Lots of flashy slow-mo clips of January 6th itself. And then, while this is happening, he talks with a Blaze Media reporter, another conservative conspiracy site that's doing real reporting, according to Tucker, who says that January 6th was just mom and dad mad about a stolen election, and those who were there just got caught up in the chaos. And with this point, they start going into the comparisons to the Black Lives Matter protests. As you might expect, Tucker frames these protests as unflinchingly and phenomenally violent. The Blaze Media reporter, in a voiceover, accuses the government of gaslighting the right that rioting was okay through their response to Black Lives Matter. So in other words, this guy believes that January 6th was a setup by the American government and the deep state through their treatment of Black Lives Matter protesters, who were unbelievably violent, apparently, that because those protests were violent, that made it okay for January 6th to be violent. And they caught us and they entrapped us into believing this.
The tricksters. The sneaky, filthy Democrats.
And to hammer this point home, they keep showing clips of the few points in BLM protests that did get violent, along with the epithet of peaceful protests repeated over and over and over and over. They say that these riots made January 6th inevitable because the right thought it would be okay for them to do the same thing that the left did, but they weren't punished for it because they were, quote, peaceful protests. And anyone who does just 2 minutes of Googling on the subject knows that this is a false comparison. In fact, I believe the statistic was around 96% of Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful. And another thing that they fail to mention when comparing the BLM protests to January 6th is that the BLM protests did not attack the Capitol. There was no BLM protest that broke into the seat of our government and tried to stop them from certifying an election. But that doesn't matter to Tucker and the right and the GOP. All that matters is the fear that this sort of narrative creates. So Tucker then comes back on and says that the media and the Democrats created the environment that made January 6th violent inevitable, but just to kind of help it along, maybe there were some agitators. And the Blaze Media reporter seconds this notion and says that there were some people at the riots that looked like professionals. Maybe they were just there to cause trouble. Tucker then brings on the senior analyst for the Center for Security Policy. A quick Wikipedia search shows that the Center for Security Policy is an anti-Muslim, far-right think tank known specifically for pushing birtherism. This guy talks about how, when he worked for the CIA, he planted misinformation in Soviet Russia. I mean, honestly, I think that would be a cooler setup for a documentary than this one. But he then goes on to say what is essentially the main premise of this documentary, that January 6th was a coordinated political warfare op by Democrats and the deep state. He says that he saw, quote, military-like precision from agitators and agent provocateurs. And my response to this, and of course, they wouldn't have known this at the time because it hadn't come out yet, but I agree with him that yes, there were people planning the storming of the Capitol. They were called the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers, and the Three Percenters. Texts, emails, and other communications uncovered by the investigations into January 6th have shown that these people did actually plan things out. The January 6th committee has revealed that there was indeed a battle plan for the Proud Boys and their right-wing allies to take over the Capitol. There was an effort to smuggle weapons. There were detailed plans made of the Capitol itself and saying there's going to be groups that go into these different areas to secure it. And just a general sense of an our time has come to rise up mentality on platforms like Gab and Parler. And just a little personal anecdote here, I know someone who lives near the area, and he told me that on the morning of January 6th, there were people in military fatigues and what looked like battle gear practicing drills in a parking lot across from his house. So this was real. There was a real plan to take over the American government, and thankfully it failed. But because this story, this real factual story, does not fit the narrative, as far as the bubble is concerned, it didn't happen and doesn't exist. And the interesting thing about this is, at this point in the documentary, I started realizing that I was seeing a pattern here. Tucker will talk to someone from a very official sounding source, like Blaze Media or Center for Security Policy, you know, pretty innocent sounding names. Because they have a fairly inconspicuous name, they seem like they'd be a reliable source for this kind of information. But as I've said, any just minute of research shows that they're actually a part of the bubble, reinforcing these conspiracy theories as fact. And this is how Tucker and the bubble in general shapes the narrative that their audience believes in. And with this in mind, it's pretty easy to see how something like January 6th could happen. Because this story, this narrative, is so perpetuated and reinforced that these people who stormed the Capitol really did believe. And at this point in the documentary, Tucker starts actually giving interviews with people who were at January 6th. They really believe that the election was stolen. But to further this narrative of January 6th being a psyop in which people were sort of just goaded into violence, they make a huge deal about John Sullivan being at January 6th. He's an anarchist who also attended BLM protests, and it's believed that he tried to instigate violence at both BLM and January 6th for personal gain and self-promotion. When he was at the Capitol, he was leading a chant in which he yelled, "We're gonna burn this shit down." And Tucker tries very hard to sort of paint him as a left-wing plant among the MAGA mob. Is he partially culpable for what happened on January 6th? Sure. But to paint him as an agent provocateur planted by the Democrats to try and escalate things is just laughable. Because, again, he did the exact same thing at BLM. He even says he's not with BLM or Antifa. He is just himself. He is an anarchist. But because this one guy was there, again, this is something we see very commonly in the bubble, they infer that because one guy did this, it must mean that the entire cabal was behind it. And as if to prove my point, the next thing they mention is that the people keeping the violent portions of the Trump mob back were other members of the Trump mob. That's right, folks. They actually take a minute out of this documentary to try and convince you that there were members of the Trump mob actually holding other people back, and that it could have and possibly should have been worse if not for them. They even take this narrative even further by saying that it was the police that instigated the violence. And so, of course, naturally, I had to look this claim up, and the only place that I could find any information on the police themselves actually instigating violence on January 6th was right-wing media sites. And so what I get from that is that it's a myth perpetuated by the bubble to further their narrative that January 6th was peaceful and it got out of control. And the only reason it got out of control wasn't because of the Trumpies, it was because of the deep state. It was because of the police. Basically, everybody except themselves is to blame for what they did. Again, this is a fairly common refrain we see in the bubble. Nothing bad that happens is ever the fault of the GOP or the Republicans or the right or Trump supporters. No, it's actually the government's fault. And they try and drag the government into January 6th at this point, saying that the groups who instigated the violence were those who had relationships with the government. Tucker even says, it may even sound like a conspiracy theory. Gee, I wonder where you'd ever get that idea. Tucker then talks about how the FBI and the government have instigated homegrown terrorist attacks, along with footage of the Oklahoma City bombing and other similar attacks that have happened on U.S. soil. He talks about a book called The Terror Factory that says that defendants on trial for terrorism were goaded by the FBI into doing what they did. And honestly, that is a pretty interesting subject matter. We're talking about sort of the post-9/11 world where we didn't really know who our enemy was. But what's wrong with this sort of characterization is that the book specifically talks about Muslim terrorists and the war on terror. And what Tucker does in this documentary is sort of use that as an umbrella to put his conspiracy theory under. It's a huge stretch to try and connect that to January 6th. We're talking about completely different time periods, completely different contexts, and completely different targets, quote unquote. And with this new information in mind, Tucker then pivots to talking about the alleged Whitmer kidnapping plot. He says that 2/3 of the people involved in the kidnapping plot were actually FBI agents. So when I looked up this claim, I saw that it's not even a mischaracterization to say that 2/3 of them were FBI agents. It's completely wrong. These agents that Tucker is referring to were actually agents assigned to monitor the kidnapping plot. And this claim, rather than the agents themselves being part of the plot, is that they were overly aggressive in encouraging the planners to go through with it. And as we know now, this is a completely ludicrous defense that did not work, and the planners of the kidnapping eventually got sentenced to a lot of time in prison. But what this does is it just fits right into the narrative that Tucker is trying to paint with this documentary of the deep state that is designed to entrap and jail conservatives. And with this in mind, Tucker then gives us just a classic non sequitur of trying to connect things that absolutely are not connected. He says that the FBI was involved in the kidnap plot, and because members of the kidnap plot were 3%ers, and 3%ers were one of the groups that planned the storming of the Capitol, therefore, the FBI must have been involved in January 6th. So he makes the connection between the FBI was involved in getting the members of the Whitmer kidnapping plot arrested, and because of that, that must mean that they're also involved in the false flag attack of January 6th. It makes absolutely no sense when examined under even just the slightest of logic. But as I've said many times before, logic does not matter in the bubble. There is no logic in this dojo! And that's pretty much the end of part one of this documentary. Tucker then asked the question of, if the government incited January 6th for a second war on terror, what else could they possibly be doing? And after what I assume is a short MyPillow commercial break, part two begins. Tucker starts right off by saying that they, meaning the deep state and the Democrats, are now purging the American ranks of anyone who doesn't think like them. He calls it a shock and awe campaign against our own people. And he punctuates this with a very provocative statement, saying, it took them 10 years to find bin Laden. They can find you a lot faster. As I said in my previous episode, one of the main things that the bubble tries to push is that they're not just coming for people like us, they are coming for you specifically. And we're going to hear more about that as this documentary goes on. Tucker then pivots to talk about the Huper raid in Alaska. So for those of you who don't know what happened, in the aftermath of January 6th, they were looking for a lot of people. And one of the people they were looking for was a woman who apparently stole Nancy Pelosi's laptop from her office. And so they thought they had found her. She was living in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Alaska. And they raided her house. And apparently what happened was it was a case of mistaken identity. She looked almost exactly like the person who stole Nancy Pelosi's laptop. And they found that she was there on January 6th, but it was the wrong person. So is it sad? Is it unfortunate? Absolutely. Should it have happened? No, of course not. But what Tucker does with this raid is paint an extraordinarily, almost hilariously sinister picture of what happened and makes a lot of interesting inferences about why it might have happened. So Tucker interviews the Hupers, and the first thing they say is that they were at January 6th, a peaceful, constitutionally protected political rally. And already, they're changing the narrative about the insurrection less than half an hour in. Huper says she was at January 6th and basically encouraged and almost forced by someone else there, saying that, oh, you guys should just go into the Capitol. And she says she didn't go in because it felt like a setup. And then in comes Tucker with the voiceover. It was. They then go into the raid itself, basically this elaborately staged, very slow motion-y shot recreation of the FBI raid, saying that they put him in handcuffs and put him on the seat and started asking him questions, and they didn't know what was going on. And then they dropped the hammer, which is, they seized my copy of the Constitution as evidence. What is that saying? I guess if you have a copy of the Constitution, that means you're considered an extreme radical. Again, this makes absolutely no sense to come to that conclusion from a logical perspective, but we're not talking about that here. We're talking about they came into this sweet middle-aged couple's home and raided their stuff and took their Constitution. And it's with this in mind that Tucker then drops a bomb. Arguably the best known line from the entire documentary. He says that the government is conducting a purge aimed at legacy Americans. And in case you didn't know what he meant by that, he further defines it for you. He says they're almost all white, almost all Republican, and they simply voted the wrong way in the last election. But that term, legacy Americans, when combined with the description of almost all white, and when you combine it even more with the fact that he's talked negatively about Black Lives Matter protests in the first part of the documentary, if the term legacy Americans is not thinly veiled white supremacy, I don't know what is. He even compares what's happening, apparently, to the de-bathification of Iraq at the end of the Iraq War. And Tucker combines this voiceover with very provocative imagery of militias training and people at the gun range and some dude going through an obstacle course with a pistol. So if you ask me, there is some very serious subliminal messaging going on here. And that message is that they, meaning the Democrats and the deep state, are coming for you, and you must be prepared to fight back with guns. So my question then is, who's really doing the escalation here? It's definitely something to think about as we go through the rest of this documentary. So it turns out that the guy going through the pistol obstacle course is named Mark Ibrahim. He's a former DEA agent who, by the way, brought his gun to the insurrection. He laments that he lost his job simply because he was near the Capitol while things were going down. Of course, they don't mention him having his government-issued firearm at a coup attempt, but that's not important here. What is important is that he's rolling the way the government's treated him since January 6th into a narrative about a government purge operation to remove extremists, by which they mean conservatives, from the military. The clips they show while he's talking about this are all without context and simply state that the Democrats are rooting out extremism in the military, which is a good thing. We shouldn't have white supremacists and fascists and anti-government extremists in the military. After all, these folks are the ones with all the guns. And if they were to get into positions of power in the military, who knows what they might be capable of? And of course, these clips put together fail to mention that in these contexts, the Democrats were talking specifically about rooting out white supremacy and fascism. But as we know, Tucker has already said that white supremacy is a Democratic code word for conservatives. And this is how he sneaks white supremacist viewpoints into his narrative. By saying that when they say white supremacists, they don't really mean white supremacists. They mean anyone who disagrees with them. When in reality, he's saying, yeah, they mean white supremacists, and you should come join us and fight. But with this narrative that's being pushed by Ibrahim in this interview comes a big emphasis on purging positions where you're allowed to have a gun. The implication, of course, being that they're coming for your guns too. But what's funny is that the example that they choose out of everything they could have possibly used here to say that the Democrats are coming after conservatives specifically to purge them is a young mother playing in a park with her kid in violation of COVID restrictions. This woman just so happens to be Emily Rainey, who led 100 people to the Stop the Steal rally. She's also well known for being anti-mask and anti-vax, even had a Facebook group called More County Citizens for Freedom, in which she posted this little nugget, quote, "As communism looms and health tyranny overwhelms us, never lose hope and fight like hell, or rather the forces of hell. I myself have fired my weapon at foreign enemies in combat, and I am here to tell you that the fight at home for our God-given rights protected by the Constitution is the real war." So again, nothing provocative about anything she's saying there. In other words, she is herself, ironically, the perfect mold for someone to become a violent extremist. And the signs are even on social media of her being that radicalized. But no, she was targeted for her COVID beliefs. And in her interview, she also furthers the narrative that because she has knowledge as a PSYOPs officer, January 6th was indeed a false flag attack perpetrated by our own government. Tucker then chimes in with his voiceover. If this wasn't an insurrection, what was it? There have been lots of government false flags over the years. One of them was possibly January 6th. He says, quote, "Fear is being used to manipulate the military into seeing millions of Americans as terrorists." Emily Rainey then makes a huge deal about the Trump and Tea Party stickers being scratched out on military bases. She uses this to say that they will one day be forced to kill American citizens for their beliefs, all because some people are scratching out Trump stickers. Tucker himself then perpetuates this even further, saying that this shows that it's an actual war, hunting down American citizens and purging them from society. In other words, they are coming for you. And with this nice little cliffhanger comes the end of part two. Moving right along, part three begins with a rather provocative claim that the left is hunting the right and sticking them in Guantanamo Bay, leaving them to rot. No, they aren't. No January 6th perpetrator has gone to Guantanamo Bay. This is just a straight-up lie. But that doesn't stop Tucker from using this as a stepping stone to say that the government is jailing American political prisoners. He turns to talking about the Patriot Act, saying, and I actually agree with him here, believe it or not, that it was a decision made from fear after 9/11. He says that many, meaning many January 6th perpetrators, have endured horrific abuse. Like the horrific abuse of the Q shaman not getting his organic food? I seem to remember that being the highest profile example of this mistreatment happening. Oh, and by the way, the Q shaman actually did end up getting his organic food. Tucker then talks about how the officers in the Capitol asked the rioters to be respectful, and apparently some of them even said, yeah, go ahead and take pictures. Regardless of the fact that's coming out now that many of the officers in the Capitol Police actually sympathize with the rioters, Tucker is now saying that because some of the guards let people in and told them to be respectful and didn't stop them from taking pictures, means that the storming of the Capitol was allowed? It's almost as if the bubble can't make up its mind whether January 6th was a chaotic riot that was spun out of control, a false flag attack by the Democrats, or simply allowed to happen by the Capitol Police. But no matter which way they try and frame it in this instance, the one constant is that you can't blame the rioters themselves. And to further show just how peaceful and nice things were on January 6th, Tucker does an interview with the guy who put his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk. By the way, he took a stun gun into the Capitol and was well known for brandishing guns on social media. In this interview, the guy reinforces the narrative of we weren't violent, we did nothing wrong by going into the building, and yet at the same time, his attorney, in his defense, says that he was pushed in involuntarily by the crowd. So, wait a minute. He went in against his will, but once he was inside, police said not to break anything, which constitutes permission that he was allowed inside in the first place? I mean, you can't have it both ways. The argument that this guy makes in conjunction with what his lawyer says is completely contradictory and absolutely ridiculous. But he does mention the part where he went to jail. And he compares the January 6th prison to Guantanamo. Says there were solitary confinements, grievous conditions, and torture. He straight up just calls it torture. A quick check on PolitiFact reveals that things did not happen this way at all. A government inspection of this specific jail that they're talking about in this documentary revealed poor conditions, indeed. But A, there was no evidence of torture. Mainly, it was poor food and some unsanitary conditions. B, more importantly, only three January 6th rioters were put there and then subsequently moved. So to say that January 6th political prisoners were put there and tortured is just flat out wrong. In fact, most January 6th defendants were put in a nearby annex, which was inspected and found to be adequate. So Tucker is just straight up lying here. He's not even stretching the truth. But what he does do is use this as an example of the purge that he's trying to say that the deep state is doing. He says that it's a second war on terror, except, and he makes this point again, they're coming for you this time. And the example he uses to say that they're not afraid to kill you if they have to is with Ashley Babbitt. Unsurprisingly, Tucker tries to paint Ashley Babbitt as a martyr to the MAGA cause. Tucker shows a short montage of Antifa protesters engaging in violence with Ashley Babbitt protesters, But the interesting thing about the way he structures this montage is that there is a lot of focus. I'd say at least a third of the shots that he uses are on a specific sign that the Antifa protesters are holding up. It says, and I apologize for the language, but I think it's important, fuck Nazis. Lots of focus on that sign and on Antifa protesters basically calling them Nazis and using the F word a lot more. To me, it almost seems as if they're trying to paint Nazis as the victims here. We can add this as yet another example in this documentary of Tucker sneaking in white supremacist viewpoints. But during this montage, Tucker does talk to the husband and mom of Ashley Babbitt, who are understandably distraught about what happened to her. But they characterize it by saying that the officer executed her without warning. This is, of course, a complete mischaracterization of what actually happened. The officer who shot Ashley Babbitt was doing his job, which was to protect members of Congress from the mob. And despite multiple warnings for her to get back, get down, and get out of the way, Ashley Babbitt did not listen and instead tried to push through the doorway that was being guarded by people pointing guns at it. And the officer felt he had no choice but to fire at her because if he hadn't, more people might have come through. So again, obviously it's unfortunate, completely terrible what happened to her. I feel bad for her family. But this officer was just doing his job and has already been cleared of any wrongdoing by an official investigation. But you wouldn't know that watching this documentary. Tucker instead characterizes it as the second war on terror had its first confirmed kill. The insinuation being, of course, that this purge didn't stop with Ashley Babbitt. It's still ongoing, and they're coming for you. And with that in mind, Tucker starts to wrap things up and concludes with what he calls the unintended consequences of the war on terror causing more terror. He says that he finds it ironic that we must spy, defame, and shoot political opponents to live in peace. He says that when we do these things, tyranny doesn't extinguish, but instead creates extremism. He then says what might be the most provocative thing in this entire documentary, which is, they're pushing you to violence, and they're doing it on purpose. But interestingly, right as it seems he's about to conclude with a call to arms and action for the political right, he instead inexplicably does a complete 180 and says, be the light, love your family, love each other. A high note, peaceful, kumbaya conclusion to an otherwise very provocative documentary. And he ends it with a patriotic montage of families, the flag, and the audio of glory, glory, hallelujah, his truth is marching on. As you can imagine, when the credits started rolling, I was sort of sitting there with a look on my face that can only be described as, what? Tucker Carlson literally just spent an hour talking about how there's a purge going on of conservatives in America and we need to fight back, and ends it with glory, glory, hallelujah, love your family? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever and is a pretty nice little nutshell for the documentary as a whole. Because just like it couldn't decide whether it wanted to end on a positive or negative note, this propaganda piece, because that's what it is, didn't know what narrative about January 6th that it wanted to promote. Was January 6th a false flag attack? Or instigated by the government's crackdown on conservatives? In this documentary, Tucker tries to have it both ways, without realizing that it literally can't be both ways. If it was the FBI and Antifa that instigated the attack, the crackdown can't be because of the violence. If it was the crackdown on conservatives that caused the MAGA movement to snap, as they insinuated in Act 1, then it couldn't have been a false flag. Tucker says that January 6th was the excuse that Democrats needed to start jailing and purging conservatives, but he also says that it was happening before January 6th ever took place, which of course is completely illogical and kind of defeats the whole point of the documentary. And I guess that's the point that I'm trying to make about this. There are just a ton of logical fallacies to go through in this documentary. But people who watch it and take it seriously never notice or even care about these logical fallacies. All they hear is, January 6th wasn't violent, the liberals caused the violence, now they're coming for you. But don't be violent, he says at the very end, after insinuating violence will be necessary to protect the conservative way of life from the overreaching government. And honestly, I feel like that ending, it seems like he put it in there for the same reason that Trump added the word peacefully to his January 6th speech. And that's plausible deniability. If someone claims violence in his name, Tucker can then say, but wait, I ended this documentary on a positive note. That means I didn't actually want to instigate any violence. But overall, aside from that admittedly strange ending, Tucker's documentary on January 6th is pretty much exactly what I expected. Propaganda designed to reinforce existing emotions and push a narrative that they are trying to create. But I would be remiss if I didn't end this segment by talking about the elephant in the room, which is the not-so-subtle nod at the end to extremism creating more extremism. So, in characterizing January 6th as a crackdown on extremists, Tucker seems to actually be embracing the term. I can't do Tucker's voice very well, but the way in which he says tyranny doesn't extinguish extremism, it creates it, is almost like he wears it as a badge of pride. And my thought on the way that he says this is that Tucker is, in a low-key way, telling Trump supporters that because this purge is happening against them, violence is justified against the state when they come for you. And to that end, this documentary is filled to the brim with subtle references to training for war against the government. We can look at the montage of training videos. We can look at the way Ibrahim goes through the pistol course. We can look at the way they characterize the Whitmer plot with flashy shots of gun range and military training and the guys who were involved in the kidnapping plot shooting AR-15s out of a car. This, in my view, is subliminal messaging in a nutshell. The documentary is not overtly calling for violence, but definitely hinting that it may be necessary and just to defend yourself and or rise up against a tyrannical Democrat government. The sudden take the high road turn at the very end, and I'm not kidding, it's literally about 20 to 30 seconds, seems more like a covering my ass scenario. It doesn't seem sincere after he's just spent the last hour telling you that the government is coming for you and taking away your guns. So, I ask, what do you think the insinuation is here? It's certainly not that a peaceful protest is how we fix this. And it's rhetoric like this that truly worries me, especially considering what's been happening in the last few weeks and the fact that a Trump indictment seems inevitable now. So I'm going to end my analysis of Tucker Carlson's Patriot Purge with a somber prediction. When Trump gets indicted, and let's be clear, he will be indicted, it's inevitable, with everything that's been coming out in the last couple of weeks. When that image comes out of Trump in handcuffs, there will likely be some sort of violence from the right. Now, what the extent or damage or even the significance of that violence is, I can't say. It could be anything from a miniature civil war to one crazy guy shooting at an FBI office with a nail gun. But something will happen. And we have the bubble filled to the brim with propaganda like this that does nothing but reinforce that narrative that they're coming for us and we need to fight back to thank for it. And the worst part about all of this is that Tucker himself probably doesn't really see or care what the possible consequences are for the things that he's pushing. He's simply a TV personality doing what he knows will make him money and make him famous. So if that analysis left you a little unnerved or scared, I don't blame you. But never fear, I'm here to lift your spirits right back up with this episode's Alex Jones Award. So before I go into this episode's award, I want to actually add on an update to our last winner, Jesse Waters. You might recall how I called him out over how he seems to be unnervingly obsessed with sex and tries to shoehorn it into everything he does. Well, this week I found out that not only is he a sex addict, he's also a creep, a pervert, and possibly a pedophile. While talking on The Five about a Missouri school board plan to allow teachers to spank students with parental consent, Jesse Waters stepped in to offer his take on what he thought was appropriate. Take a listen.
If I had children, I would want to take care of the paddling myself.
Can you paddle female students?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no distinction.
You can. And on the butt, right? Not in the hand.
On the butt. It's on the butt.
And how many smacks do you get?
I think to three.
Up to three.
Three. And you cannot cause physical harm.
Well, what's the line?
Well, physical harm
Tears?
Is physical injury.
Tears where, don't count.
No, where you leave a mark.
Where you leave a mark?
Yeah.
But how do you know?
If you didn't catch that, Jesse seems very interested in exactly what the line is for these spankings, which, by the way, I am completely 100% against corporal punishment. But if you see his face in the video, it's almost as if he's got a sick sort of slight smile across his face, like he's getting some sort of weird sexual thrill out of imagining spanking underage schoolgirls. So long story short, this shows that Jesse Waters is even weirder and more perverted than we originally thought he was. I just thought it was worth a mention, so let's move on to this episode's winner. And today's Alex Jones Award goes to Breitbart, specifically Breitbart's distribution wing. This whole episode today has been about how people like Tucker Carlson and networks like Fox News are pushing a specific narrative by using these documentaries and pseudo true story kind of films and shows. But this example I'm about to share with you definitely takes it to another, arguably much stranger level. Breitbart is the distributor for a new film. This film is called My Son Hunter. And what is My Son Hunter about? It's a biopic about Hunter Biden. This first came to my attention when Breitbart released a teaser back on August 19th showing lots of cocaine, drugs, partying by the guy playing Hunter Biden, and of course, it couldn't be complete without the hair sniffing of a Secret Service agent played by Gina Carano of Joe Biden himself. So I kept track of it, and in the last couple of days, Breitbart actually released the entire trailer for My Son Hunter, and it's something, ladies and gentlemen. Let me just give you a little snippet of the audio to give you an idea of what it's all about.
What kind of a moron forgets to pick up his laptop at a repair shop? You're a Biden. Act like one.
Everything he built, his life, I just ruined it all.
I want to know everything that's on that laptop that can ruin my erection.
So did you catch that little bit at the end there? He didn't say election, he said erection. Because, you know, Joe Biden is senile. And yet, also in this trailer, he's painted as sort of a mafia boss, and old, senile, creepy, and perverted. And actually, there's an extended shot of the one that was in the teaser of him actually kissing Gina Carano's neck and being super creepy. But beyond those couple of lines in the beginning referencing the laptop, which I assume is going to be the major plot point of the movie, they don't really mention it for the rest of the trailer. Instead, the rest of it is stuffed to the brim with glamorous shots of Hunter Biden, the guy that plays Hunter Biden anyway, having wild parties, drinking lots of alcohol, sniffing lots of cocaine, and having lots of sex. And it's clear this is the aspect of Hunter Biden that they want to focus on. Which is kind of funny, because the way that they focus on it, it almost seems as though they're actually glorifying it. You'd have to watch the trailer for yourself to really get the idea, and I would highly recommend you do that, because it's just hilarious. But I feel like the whole thing they're trying to do with this movie is to run a smear campaign against the Bidens and saying that they're just this corrupt mafia-style family. But the irony is that in trying to show Hunter Biden as this crazy party kind of guy, the way they shoot it, the way they structure the trailer, it almost looks as if they're trying to make him look cool. Just the way that the trailer is structured and the way that the party scenes are shot and the music behind it, everything just seems like, wow, this Hunter guy seems like he's really cool. Everyone wants to party with Hunter. To the point even that lots of comments on the Twitter post itself from the movie's Twitter account talk about how cool the trailer makes Hunter look. Here's a few of my favorites. Hunter Biden looks really cool. This makes me want to vote for Hunter. I hope he runs for president. All I'm getting from this trailer is that the guy loves to party. Here's a comment from a non-American saying, if I was American, having seen that trailer, this film would make me vote for Biden. Then there's some other responses just straight up making fun of it. For example, feels like watching a trailer for an action version of The Room. But my favorite responses are the ones that invoke Donald Trump Jr., who is well known for being a little eccentric, shall we say. There are plenty of responses with photos of what appear to be a blitzed out of his mind Donald Trump Jr., including one response that says, now do my son Don Jr., and they've photoshopped him into the photo from Scarface with all the cocaine around Al Pacino. But my personal favorite response? Seems like the best choice to play Hunter here would be Don Jr. I mean, this is becoming such a thing now that Don Jr. himself actually felt the need to address it. Here he is talking about how a lot of people think he uses cocaine.
I know they love to say, because I'm a rather animated guy, that apparently I have a cocaine addiction every time I speak.
No, I don't have a cocaine addiction. I don't.
Projection, anyone? But my point is that this trailer is just an absolute work of art. It's hilarious. It's amazing. I can't wait to see the whole movie and just laugh at how terrible it is and how inaccurate it is, and possibly even do an episode on it and break it down if I'm able to. So congratulations, Breitbart. Your new movie, My Son Hunter, and its trailer that makes Hunter Biden look really cool, is the winner of this week's Alex Jones Award. All right, folks, so that's going to do it for this episode of the Undercover Bubble Podcast. I want to thank you once again for joining me. If you like the podcast, feel free to subscribe and tell all your friends. You can also find the show on Twitter at @UCB_podcast or my personal Twitter at @PMOTheMusicMan. I'll see you next time, folks. Have a good one.